Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Carrie Beecham, whose latest book is Joseph P. Kennedy Presents, His Hollywood Years. Carrie Beecham is the author of other nonfiction works, including Without Laying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood, Adventures of a Hollywood Secretary, Anita Loos Rediscovered, co-author of a book about the Cannes Film Festival, Hollywood on the Riviera, wrote the documentary The Day My God Died before 1990, a private investigator and campaign manager and the press secretary to Jerry Brown when he was governor of California.
A checkered past.
You've been very involved in writing about Hollywood in the 1920s and 1930s. And before we get into Joseph Kennedy, what draws you to that era so that all of these books, and in fact, even before then, in the late 90s, you were writing articles for the L.A. Times on Amelia Earhart, other people from that era. What is it about the era that draws you?
One of the other items on the little resume is that I was also the first state chair of the California National Women's Political Caucus back in the early 70s. And so women and their role in society has always been a passion of mine. And I also always loved movies. And one of the things that drove me to write Without Lying Down was I kept seeing all these women's names as writers. And when I learned that over half of all films written before 1925 were written by women, I knew there was a story there, and I wanted to know more. I soon discovered that Hollywood, during the silent era, was primarily made up of women and Eastern European Jews, people who never would have been accepted in any other profession. Hollywood was a magnet for these creative entrepreneurs who were rejected from other aspects of society but could flourish and blossom in Hollywood. Often women were protagonists in the film. I mean, as compared to now, as one of my writer friends says, women as wallpaper. It was a Joan Crawford movie. It was a Gloria Swanson movie. They were the one and only stars of their films.
You were a private investigator, too.
Yeah, which turns out to be the absolute best training a biographer could have had. I had absolutely no idea, but it really is, in the sense that first thing you learn is you can find that information. It will be there. You also learn, I mean, as Mommy used to say, the worst they can do is say no. You'll ask anybody close to anything and keep digging. You turn into the little engine that could.
Unlike a journalist who has to write for the newspaper who needs that quote, you go, okay, I can't do this, you just do an end run. You need the information.
You need the information. And also, life is simpler as a biographer if you are dealing with people who are dead.
But you can't get firsthand information
either.
No,
but you have relatives. You have friends. One of the things that happened for this book is I gained access to the interview transcripts that have been conducted in the 80s for the Thames PBS show, The Kennedys. And so not just the little blurbs that had been in the documentary, but hundreds and hundreds of pages of interviews with over 40 people who had known Joe Kennedy.
You got into Joe Kennedy's life when you were working on a book about Frances Marion, who was a very famous screenwriter, and you kept running across the name Joe Kennedy.
It was incredible, because at the time, what we knew about Frances was that she had written over 200 produced films, but very little about her personal life. And yet I found in the trades and the fan magazines of the day a lot of references to her. So I went through page by page, Film Daily, Variety, throughout the 20s, and I kept getting diverted by the name Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy predicts this. Joe Kennedy buys that. Joe Kennedy company might merge with this company, over and over again. My goodness, I knew the guy had been here a little bit, but no idea. Nothing's worse when you're researching something to be diverted by something else. It's so frustrating. So I just cut a little deal with myself, and I just started copying the Kennedy articles. I didn't read them. I just copied them, and then at the end of my research on Frances Marion, I had a substantial file on Joe Kennedy.
There have been many bios on Kennedy and about the Kennedy family, of course, is the most famous family in America. And yet, at the same time, his years in Hollywood were not particularly well documented.
Well, not at all, but I found in the biographies of Kennedy was that they oftentimes primarily used the information Joe himself had provided. His story was, in 1926, a phone call came in, serendipitously finds he owns a studio. But in reality, he had been tilling the fields of film business since 1919 for 7 years, the ups and downs of that. But he left that off his personal resume.
Cary Beecham, before we go into some of the specifics, a broad outline of Kennedy's world of Hollywood is he came in, he was a banker in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to invest in, what was it? Was that FBO at that point?
That was in the early 20s, yes, RC FBO. In 1919, there's over 100 film companies in Los Angeles. In the early 30s, there's 8. I mean, that is how quickly those mergers took place.
And in a sense, as the first Hollywood money man, someone who knew mm-hmm. money as opposed to the seamstresses
exactly.
and tailors who ran, mm-hmm. and fur merchants who ran Hollywood at the time, he knew what he was doing with money, and he was able to make a killing, an absolute killing. He walked in and basically stepped on everyone and took over the field in a way.
He certainly did. He remains the only man ever to run 4 companies simultaneously. No one else has ever run more than one.
And that was FBO, Pathé, and First National, which were all studios, and KAO, which was a vaudeville circuit.
Right, 700 theaters, vaudeville circuit. And he took that over and proceeded to immediately turn them all into movie theaters.
Which is one of the things that I found fascinating, because we hear about how film killed vaudeville. Yet you say, Cary Beecham, that in fact it wasn't film that killed vaudeville, it was Joseph P. Kennedy.
Well, what I say is, I had always thought that that phrase meant that people chose to see movies
right,
instead
exactly.
of seeing vaudeville. What I realized writing this is that what happened was film took over all those venues. So when Kennedy takes 700 vaudeville theaters, turns them all into movie theaters, those vaudevillians have no place to perform.
And this was the very top of the heap. This was the famous Orpheum Circuit.
Absolutely.
Would it have happened anyway?
Not with the speed that it did. Because when you're looking back at Hollywood then and you see Louis B. Mayer at MGM and Zucker and Schulberg at Paramount, for instance, and Lasky, you see men who built those studios brick by brick, men who had a creative long view of what they were doing. I'm not saying these were nice guys by any matter of means, but they did have a loyalty to their community. They viewed their studio as their life. And in comes Joe Kennedy, who has his eye really only on next quarter's profits. He's in, he's out. He doesn't give a damn what anybody thinks about him. I mean, he promotes himself as this great savior. And in fact, the press cover him like that. But he isn't in it for the long haul like all these other men are.
The two elements of that that struck me most in reading, particularly the first two-thirds of his Hollywood years, because then it gets more into the personalities as he slowly mm-hmm. disentangles himself in the 30s and moves on to the Roosevelt administration. But the two areas that struck me from a political sense, and you as a former political activist, mm-hmm. you had to have been seeing parallels. The first is the fawning nature of the press, and the second is that the people who destroyed the economy in the past year and 2 years are just like Joseph Kennedy.
The similarities are amazing. And when he goes to Roosevelt, he sees in the early 30s, power is moving from Wall Street to Washington. He's going to be a part of that. And unlike some of the people today who have to be dragged kicking and screaming into this new reality, Joe Kennedy turned on a dime.
It seems as if it would be the equivalent of Obama selecting Bernie Madoff.
Not quite. But when you think of Roosevelt appointing Kennedy as the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and Roosevelt supposedly chuckled and said, well, it takes a thief to catch a thief. And yet, of all the things that Kennedy did in his lifetime, you really have to acknowledge that he was a brilliant head of the SEC. The people he brought in, the rules he put into place, he knew exactly how he had used and abused the system for the previous 20 years. And he, as I say, he turned on a dime and put in the rules, many of which are still the same rules to show you how totally out of date we've gotten, that he implemented back in the early 30s.
And many of those rules have since disappeared, which is why we had
exactly.
the new
era.
Exactly.
And I swear, if we had him now, he... As horrible as he was in certain ways, certainly personal relationships, he would never have allowed debt ratio to go above 6-1. If he had been in those meetings, he would have blasted. If anybody understood real value and what it meant, it was Joe Kennedy.
The first part of the book, the research trying to work out the strings of money, the way he manipulated, the way he made his money. That sounds like an extraordinary chore, and attempting to put it in the context where those of us who don't know finance could understand it sounds to me like, in many ways, the hardest part of the book.
Well, I had to understand it, and then I had to put it into language that everybody else could understand it. But since, as you mentioned, I mean, the other biographies of Kennedy give two or three pages to his entire time in Hollywood, and they don't talk about how he actually made his money. So that was my challenge. I had to go back and reconstruct exactly how he had done it, understand it myself, and then simplify it in a way, and yet explain it and keep it whole.
There are little threads from the other reading I've done over the years. For instance, you know, Art Buchwald's book about how Hollywood stole Coming to America.
Right.
The accounting system, the double and triple billing that Paramount used and that got completely torn apart by the courts at that particular time, Kennedy originated that.
One of the things that attracted him to movies, I mean, we discovered them in 1919. He said, oh, my God, this is another telephone. I mean, this is a gold mine. I got to get into it. And other bankers didn't realize it. Well, part of the reason that they didn't realize it was the unreality of movie assets. What is a poster worth? Nothing is worth anything until it's in the theater. Up until then, the accounting that had been going on for films were once a month. They'd send something back to New York saying, we're going to need this much money the next month. Not Joe. He instituted these 12-point programs on a weekly basis. They were checked and double-checked. Every single film was individually budgeted. He certainly did the blueprint for that kind of accounting.
Well, up until his time with the SEC, I mean, the man was a horror. He lied to everyone. He cheated people. We'll talk in a moment about how he destroyed lives. He was what you call him, a hollow figure. I think there's another quote. He shifted the gears of an entire industry towards short-term financial thinking, which has so penetrated the rest of America that we're still reeling from that particular philosophy. He kept in touch with his children long from far away. Mm-hmm. He had a very visible affair that must have been disastrous for Rose Kennedy. Everything he touched, he made money on, and, of course, he destroyed so much. And yet, you kept on this for all those years. Was it the fact that you knew that at some point he would almost become a good guy, that you could deal with his earlier years?
No, it wasn't that he would become a good guy. It was that I really wanted to understand him. I also was fascinated with the end result. I mean, his children, I mean, one of the words you would use for his children is empathetic. Senator Teddy, Bobby, Jack, Eunice, Special Olympics. These are some really incredible people, caring, empathetic people who've devoted their lives to public service, total 160 degrees opposite of the patriarch.
One thing that's clear toward the end of the book in quoting the kids, or at least mm-hmm. Jack, is that none of them had any illusions about their father either.
No, I don't think they did, but they did have an unconditional love for him because they felt, I believe, that he had an unconditional love for them. I mean, one of the most interesting quotes I came across actually was given to me by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who said that at one point he had asked Jack, why do you think the Kennedy kids turned out so well relative to, like, the Roosevelt kids or the Churchill kids? And Jack said, well, it certainly wasn't because of my mother. But, you know, Dad wasn't around often, but he kept the laser beam on us. And I could fall flat on my face, and Dad would say to me, yes, but the way you picked yourself up was magnificent. He left public life in 1940. He devoted his energies to his kids' careers. Joe had had a rather complicated relationship with Roosevelt, but when Joe Jr. is killed in the war, he goes behind closed doors. He's incredibly bitter. He later tells Truman, how can you support that crippled son of a bitch that killed my son Joe? A lot of bitterness that never left him.
You're listening to an interview with Carrie Beecham, whose book is Joseph P. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years. Joe Kennedy, along the way, destroyed lives. There was a guy named Fred Thompson, and we're not talking Fred Thompson with a P. We're talking he was an actor and politician. We're talking Fred Thompson, T-H-O-M-S-O-N. I've followed film, but I had not heard of this guy. He was the number two cowboy star behind Tom Mix in the 20s. Joe Kennedy destroyed his life by buying his contract and not letting him make films. Frances Marion, his wife, claimed He died of a broken heart.
And Francis said that he'd lost his will to live. I mean, the death certificate says tetanus, and I believe he did step on a rusty nail, and they just didn't diagnose it correctly.
He was 38.
But, yeah, 38, Christmas Day, 1928, is when Fred died. But I'll tell you, in this, as horrible as that was, and there are other people that he did similar things to, what I realized in doing the research was that not only did Joe Kennedy take his contract, insist that he not make any movies, Fred wasn't only number two star. I mean, Doug Fairbanks was number eight on this list. I mean, that's how big Fred was. And Joe Kennedy had the life insurance on him and collected that. But I let out a gasp because I didn't understand. How come we know Tom Mix now and we don't know Fred Thompson? When they discovered there were 200 tins of Fred Thompson films in what had become the RKO vaults, and Joe's underlings and these half a dozen men who worked for Joe, which were the key to success in many ways, were cabling each other back and forth. We found all these Thompson films. What should we do? One, make sure you have all the story rights in case Joe wants to make them again, but we can get a penny a foot for scrap film, so just sell them. So we don't know who Fred Thompson is because in the process, Joe Kennedy destroyed his life work, all of his films.
So in other words, Kennedy not only kept him from making films, which broke his heart, he stole, through his company, the insurance money that would have gone to Thompson's kids.
Paid, the company had paid the insurance. I mean, it was all very legal. Very rarely do you find Joe Kennedy falling into blatant illegality. He skirts the edges all the time. You know, it was legal. It was shockingly immoral, but it was legal.
And on some level, do you think there was any conscience? I mean, there's a list of people. E.B.
No.
Durr, Guy Currier,
right.
Gloria
oh, yes.
Swanson,
right.
Edmund Goulding, all of them. And Goulding yeah. walks away, the director walks away going, well, you win some, you lose some. But he's the one who got away clean.
I came to the conclusion that Joe's attitude was, it was all a game. It was all a game. He saw everybody through the lens of dollars and cents. Adolf Hitler, Gloria Swanson, everybody through the lens of dollars and cents. I think his attitude was, if I screwed you, it's your own fault. You let yourself be screwed. If you stop me from screwing you, well, you know, more power to you, but, you know, I'll get you tomorrow.
It reminds me of something Molly Ivins once said in talking about the Bush administration. She said, these people think they're playing a game, but they don't understand that their policies kill people.
Exactly. And, I mean, in some ways, when you talk about asking me about how I could spend that much time with this man, in many ways, I say this book got me through the Bush years because I could spend my days saying, oh, God, I can't deal with reality. I'm going to go spend my day in 1928, you know. And yet the corollaries, there were so many that it was a little bring me back and forth.
Well, the other thing, of course, fascinating is that because this is the origin of Hollywood, we also learn how all the studios came to be, particularly RKO and the story of David Sarnoff.
It was fascinating. They're a fascinating duo to me, Joe Kennedy and David Sarnoff.
What was Sarnoff's politics?
He was an incredible story, but, you know, he's an immigrant coming over. I mean, his father dies young. He comes with his, he's the oldest brother. He's working by the time he's 9 years old in New York, a telegraph operator, clearly a brilliant man, but also very, very quiet and very basically conservative. He's attracted by Joe Kennedy because Joe Kennedy has the studio. Sarnoff has the technology, the sound stuff, to come together. And it was with two of Kennedy's companies, with KAO and FBO, that they created RKO, the first studio made exclusively to make sound films. But very quickly, Sarnoff, once he really starts dealing with Kennedy, he's had enough of him. He sees the way he's double-dealing him. He sees that he's just using his machinery and he's not getting paid for it. Sarnoff buys him out, just says, that's enough, get out of here. Here's your money, go away. But he stays quiet about it. As
right.
the other people who caught on to Joe, who caught on to what they were doing, they stay quiet about it. Because in the press, Kennedy was golden.
It took people a few years, but not that many. He comes in 1926, yet by the early 30s, 31 mm-hmm. or so, they've kind of figured out a way to get rid of him, so he's dumped out of First National, which gets bought by Warner Brothers. Sarnoff throws him out of KAO and FBO, and then eventually he gets even thrown out of Pathé, and he's left essentially with just Gloria Swanson.
Gloria Swanson and Pathé, but by then, you have to remember that with each quote-unquote throwout, he's making millions of dollars. He's selling these things. He's also when he's with Pathé, unbeknownst to the money men around him, he's jacking up the price of the stock by sending out these tip sheets and every other, you know, quasi-legal, because, I mean, as they say, bankers then were running the roulette machine. You know, they could do anything they wanted. And so he's artificially raising the prices of these stocks. Other money men who they've given him these stocks assume he's holding them. But he's selling them. He's got 100,000 shares of Pathé. He's selling them in 200 to 300 blocks of shares, but under the names of his underlings in different accounts throughout the country. So his last, I mean, but talk about brilliance and timing and luck. The last Pathé sale of stock, October 20th, 1929.
It's astounding. He foresaw the crash of 29 and got out.
And that's another, you know, Joe Kennedy special story, as it were. He told people, and has been repeated so many times, it's just in a new book I just saw a couple of months ago, it's the same story. Joe Kennedy said that, oh, well, I was getting my shoes shined on Wall Street one day, and when the guy says to me, I'll give you a tip, I knew it was time to get out. But in reality, he had been methodically getting out for over a year. He had to have incredible discipline to do that, because in the summer of 29, stocks went up again, and he's still methodically selling out, and kept most of it in cash, some in bonds. By then, he also had at least 4 Delaware corporations that he was doing his business under.
As you were reading that and you were watching America's economics fall apart here, what was going on through your head?
How the more things change, the more they stay the same. Nothing new under the sun. There were so many things. I mean, even the last 2 or 3 years as I'm working on this, these things are going off in my brain. The banks mixing with the markets. The banks all of a sudden can sell stock. I'm going, oh, my God.
One of the great stories inside his Hollywood years is the story of the film Queen Kelly, which eventually was kind of released in the late 80s, reconstructed. Have you seen that film?
Oh, yes, of course. And it is truncated at best, but I also have read all the scripts, all the versions. Gloria Swanson had come to Kennedy initially because she had become her own producer. So she comes to him. She's $500,000 in debt and says, you know, help me out here, because he's golden, because he's the one bank. He's a banker who also understands movies as this transition to sound time is happening. And he says, oh, my darling, we will make important movies together. We will make these grand epics together. And I think when he hired Stroheim, of course, was known for Greed and half a dozen gorgeous epics. However, everyone in Hollywood, producer-wise, knew about Stroheim, knew what a spendthrift he was, knew that you could never keep him to a budget. He had not worked for 2 years when Joe Kennedy hired him. I find it akin to, you know, the ball player who ruins every clubhouse he's in, but there's always one manager, GM, or who thinks, oh, I can handle him, I can handle him. And Joe Kennedy thought he could handle Stroheim, and in the end, he couldn't.
The film itself, this was this giant, expensive epic that never came to fruition and was eventually abandoned. Has the story of Queen Kelly been documented elsewhere?
There's a couple of documentaries there's one on Stroheim, which talks about it. I was surprised, really, how little it had been, and realizing, being in Kennedy's papers and then in Swanson's papers, I see how early on they approved this wonderful story, and that was the first time my jaw dropped, because right there on Stroheim on the printed page is the story of this, you know, the Catholic virgin at the convent who then inherits her aunt's brothel in Africa. And yes, we're pre-code, but we're not that pre-code. How they ever thought they were going to get this past the censors is beyond me. I mean, they must have just been so filled with self-righteousness that they thought they could pull off anything.
There's a quote from Michael Korda who says that all of these people came to Hollywood because it was a good way to get laid. Do you think that's part of what attracted Joseph P. Kennedy there?
He'd been around Broadway showgirls for a long time and apparently had never had a problem getting laid. But I do think that, yes, that was part of the attraction for sure. He loved the spotlight, though. He put himself into all his ads. I mean, I chose the title Joseph P. Kennedy Presents because that was the tagline that was over 100 films. He loved seeing himself out there as this great promoter, this great showman.
You're the private investigator. How did you find out that he was lousy in bed?
Well, Gloria Swanson's daughter, for first time, Gloria, you know, mentions it. And also Marlene Dietrich's daughter, both were very cooperative with me, and Swanson's daughter had never spoken to a biographer before, and yet she was wonderful with me and very generous with her time. And so she was one of those, you know, Mom didn't tell me a lot, but.
Do you believe Marlene Dietrich when she told Jack Kennedy that she had never slept with Joe?
No. I did a piece in Vanity Fair for it, and we were joking about it because Marlena, being the one person that we're fairly sure, at least Marlena's who slept with both father and son, and you don't get more Vanity Fair than that, you know. And again, Dietrich's daughter was very wonderfully cooperative with
me. Maria Riva?
Right.
And you read her book as...
Oh, of course.
Yeah. There's a book I noticed that you didn't cite at all,
book
called, and maybe it's not in there, Close Up on Sunset Boulevard by Sam Staggs.
Oh, yeah. Well, Sunset Boulevard, I mean, by the time we get to Sunset Boulevard in the 50s, I mean, that's past the time, and I did spend quite a... Nancy Olson, who's in Sunset Boulevard, is a good friend. She helped me a lot. Things like that. But one of the things that was in one of the drafts, and I'm not even sure if it's there, but in Sunset Boulevard, when the Gloria Swanson character is watching a little bit of silent movies.
That's Queen
Kelly. Queen Kelly, and that was, of course, the first and only time through until the 80s that it was shown in the United States. So they did use some, and of course, Stroheim is in Sunset Boulevard as an actor. So you get this incredibly small world feeling about the connection of Sunset Boulevard.
Did you read the Staggs book?
Yes, I did.
Joe Kennedy... and censorship. He was very good friends with Will Hayes,
mm-hmm.
and we have a bad memory of Hayes because of what happened with the code, yet actually that was Breen. It was Hayes' job mm-hmm. to ensure that the code, in a way, wasn't enforced.
In a way that there didn't have to be a code.
Right.
And obviously at the end it was a balancing act. I mean, he's very much like a Joe Valenti, a lobbyist for the film industry, Hayes initially. Promoting the film industry as this healthy, vibrant business that's good for America. And when Joe Kennedy becomes a studio owner in 26 and all the other studio owners are these European Jews, Will Hayes proclaims Joe Kennedy a wonderful addition to the business. And, oh, this is fabulous because he's a real American.
Carrie Beecham, you never come out and say it, and Kennedy had friends who were Jewish, a number of close friends, yet there's a strain of anti-Semitism that runs right through the book.
It ran right through Joe Kennedy. When you say I don't come out and say it, one of the things that I found when I read certainly the more recent books about the Kennedys, as a reader I objected to the attitude of almost taking a mallet to your head, saying, see how awful this was, see how awful this was. I really wanted the story to tell the story. Have it evolve and have his character evolve, and I hope that I've accomplished that. But, yes, he was anti-Semitic. I mean, Gloria Swanson's last husband told me that one of the things that bonded Joe and Gloria was their joint anti-Semitism, that they would talk about them, how they were going to conquer them, and what, you know, the whole separation. There's no question of his anti-Semitism, but then I always have to back up a little because people will assume that he supported Hitler, that he was pro-Germany, and I don't think it went that far. I think he thought that Germany was going to win, therefore he wanted to be on the winning side. I think he viewed Hitler as an adversarial CEO. He believed it could be negotiated. But he also, Joe also in 1940, came back to Hollywood, gave a lecture to 20 studio heads and told them to get those Jewish names off the screen because Hitler liked movies. If they wanted to continue to sell their films abroad, The Great Dictator had just been released. Joe was shocked that they would be allowed to be out. You have to, you know, come on, guys, don't we all want to make money here? Let's, you know, and besides, if those Jewish names keep staying on the screen and you're making anti-Third Reich movies, well, it's going to become a Jewish war and that'll be worse for you. And I think as absolutely shocking and horrific as that was, almost as bad, if not worse, is that most of them listened to him.
And even as late as the end of the war, he was against the war.
After Pearl Harbor, he knew it had to be fought, and he was as supportive as he could be. But by then, he and Roosevelt had such a severe split, there was just no communicating.
The other area that kind of threads a little bit, more toward the end in Jack Kennedy's election, was his relationship to the mafia, which goes back to bootlegging. It wasn't that he was a bootlegger. It's that he bought all the contracts for all of the good liquor over in In
this
Britain.
Is what I mean about him skirting the edges. I mean, the man, you got to say, you got to acknowledge his brilliance and his perceptance, the way he can predict what's going to happen. Well, I have no doubt he was loaning money to the mob. I mean, my God, this man was a president of a small bank in 1914, and what's a bank besides a great money laundromat, you know? But I don't see him as really involved, particularly in the later years of Prohibition. With Roosevelt, he was able to get those medicinal licenses. I mean, Chicago alone, there were 300,000 prescriptions, quote unquote, for liquor during Prohibition. And Kennedy got those licenses, takes Roosevelt's son to London as if he's the equivalent of the Prince of Wales, gets the exclusive rights to all the British scotch and liquor, and brings it all over to America just in time to have it distributed throughout the country as Prohibition's lifted.
The Kennedy fortune kept growing. Did he get into real estate?
He did get into real estate big. He bought, well, the Merchandise Mart. He got into a lot of real estate, but the Merchandise Mart in Chicago is the best example because it was, what, the largest building next to the Pentagon in the United States. And he's timing on buying these things. He bought it for less than it had cost to build. He bought his house in Palm Beach in the 30s for $100,000. I mean, his timing is 9 times out of 10 absolutely impeccable.
And the people that he worked with, I mean, he left their bodies in his wake, but many of them made all their money as his underlings.
Yes, what they did make. He started out with half a dozen loyalists. Gloria called them the Four Horsemen, but there were really six. And in the end, two of them were left. Johnny Ford and Eddie Moore, who, of course, Teddy was named after.
Carrie Beecham, as you did your research, how did your impression of Kennedy and the people around him shift and change?
You know, I tried to enter it without that much of an impression. I wanted to understand him. I wanted to understand more about that era. What it taught me was what a tremendous influence he was in those shifting of the gears of Hollywood. I had the advantage over other biographers because I was already a Hollywood historian. I understood how the studios had worked. I understood the growth of the studios and the transition, the tremendous shift, and the fear that had permeated Hollywood in the late 20s during that transition to sound. So I came in with that knowledge. I had not realized how Kennedy was the architect of today's Hollywood, how he was the first one to make those changes, and his incredible influence on so many people. And yet, it's this chapter in his life that almost didn't exist. He did so much from then on, and he's known for so many other things. Much of it might be common knowledge and not our urban legend, but that's what people think of him. They don't know him as this incredible influence in Hollywood.
And incredible influence in the philosophy of making money. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the part of it that blew my mind, is that this guy was the prototype for Carl Icahn, for all of these people.
Oh, yeah, Kerkarian, you name it. I mean, Murdoch in the sense of the loyalty. I mean, he has the vision of Ted Turner, but then it's the Icahn and the Kerkarian and the just buy and sell, cut and paste, slice and dice, and make a profit at every turn.
And leave things in their wake.
Whatever, didn't matter. Just move on. Not my fault. They let me do it. It's not my fault.
Carrie Beecham, Without Lying Down, became a documentary. Are you going to do a documentary on Joseph P. Kennedy?
Well, documentaries require visuals, so we'll see. There have been nibbles, and we've been talking, so I don't know yet. This is just out.
Outside of interviewing people and doing a lot of talking heads, what does exist of Joe Kennedy image-wise?
Well, there's an awful lot of interviews. Things with him, if not so much in the 20s, but it's certainly starting in the 30s. At the SEC, and he was calling press conferences. He took what he learned about the art of celebrity in Hollywood and took it with him to Washington. He got more press than any other studio owner in Washington. He got more press than anybody else in the Roosevelt administration, except the president himself, and sometimes even more than the president.
As a political activist, you read this book. What can you learn?
Go back to the great old axiom, speak truth to power. Nobody called him on this, but people knew. And when you think of the people who did know things and then kept quiet, that's where I get sad. I mean, it's if they'd spoken up, if somebody had said the emperor has no clothes somewhere along the line. So I think the importance of that runs through this.
Carrie Beecham, now Obama is president, and Jerry Brown, your old boss, is thinking of running for governor. Do you see yourself getting back into politics?
Well, I've never really left. I mean, I've stayed working pro-choice with women in campaigns on the side, you know, not full-time like I was doing because I'm a full-time writer, but certainly stayed in contact with everything. And it is nice to be able to have this finished. I was able to cover Obama in Berlin. I was doing research on Dietrich and was privileged to go see that incredible display. So it's awfully nice to put my head up and find myself in 2009 and see some people doing some things that look hopeful for the first time in a while, having a grown-up as president again, a president who can, you know, speak in continued sentences. It's very refreshing.
But at the same time, we have Summers and Geithner talking with Obama. Mm-hmm. They're not Joe Kennedy taking over the SEC.
No, I never thought as much as it, because, you know, in so many ways, so much of what Joe did was despicable, but I never thought I would say this, but boy, do we need Joe Kennedy now. We could really use him at the SEC or Treasury.
You're in touch with Jerry Brown. What do you think his chances are?
Oh, I think they're excellent. I mean, I think they're excellent. Everybody, we just had a conversation the other day about who else was running, but, you know, I have to say, I was just thinking this morning when Obama's out there talking about the bullet trains. I thought, well, you know, that's what Jerry was talking about in the 70s. And if we'd listened a little bit more to him on the energy, or if he'd been able to get a few more people behind him in geothermal and the things that we were trying to do in the 70s. I mean, think where California could be today environmentally.
As an Oakland A's fan, Jerry Brown's attitude toward the A's I found fairly despicable. Mm-hmm. What's the story behind his view toward essentially not caring whether they stayed or went?
I don't think it was that he didn't care. I think Jerry just doesn't understand the importance of sports to a lot of people. And I think if he'd had people around him who could have explained to him that if not the importance of sports and that sense of that community and what sports can do to a community, it was a question of, to go back to Joe, what Joe would be, it's a brand. It's branding Oakland to the world. And that's what the Oakland A's did, and that should have been appreciated, even if sports as a sense of community couldn't have been.
Do you think the United States has turned a corner?
Internationally, yes. Hearing from friends all over the place. I mean, when I try to spend at least a month a year in Europe, and last summer, I have to tell you, so many people, when they'd say, do you think Obama has a chance? And I'd say, yeah, yes, I do. They looked at me like I was some naive fool. They really did. They just could not believe. And these are people who follow American politics more than most Americans do, you know. Boy, did I hear from them after the day after election. They were happier. They were happy for us. They want to like America. They really do want to like America. And we'd given them a reason to do that again.
Carrie Beecham, now you've finished this massive project, Joseph P. Kennedy Presents. What are you working on now?
I'm not. Isn't it glorious? I write for Vanity Fair, so I'm working on another piece for them. It's nice not having anything for a while. It's nice to be back in the real world on a full-time basis.
Could you see yourself working on a bio of Swanson, or would that be too difficult?
No, it wouldn't be too difficult because I have all the access now from her papers, from her daughter, and everybody was very generous. But I do have to say, when I worked on Frances Marion and the Women of Early Hollywood, it was a joy to get up in the morning. It was a joy to know I was going to spend my day with my dead girlfriends. These were fabulous, fun, smart women who taught me wonderful things about the world and about life and all kinds of fabulous things. Spending every day with Joe Kennedy has not been all that pleasant. It's been very stimulating intellectually, and I've learned things financially. I've learned things I never would have known any other way. But he's not a nice person to spend your days with. Gloria was also a very selfish person. I'm not sure. I've been asked to do that. I'm thinking about it. But personally, I don't know if I want to go spend my time with those kind of people.
Yeah, I've heard that biographers either come to love or come to hate their subjects.
I just think you come to know them. You come to know them very well. And you also get to collect along the way this extended family of friends of theirs. Frances Marion's secretary turned 101 in February. She lives in Palm Springs. I visit her every 2 months. I love her. She's just still very much with us. So you have, you know, this web of people who enter your life, and that's one of the real gifts. There's so many gifts to doing this. You're free to ask questions. You're free to really investigate things that interest you. It's a wonderful life in many ways.
The one thing about the book, and you mentioned it before, that struck me was the non-judgmental nature. You worked very hard to be non-judgmental.
I just don't comment. I just try to let the story tell the story. This book actually started as a piece for Vanity Fair back in 2000, and as Kennedy's studio mogul. And one of the letters that we got afterwards was somebody said, you know, great article, but why didn't she come out and say he was a crook? And I thought, the story said he was a crook. I don't need to say he was a crook. I resent it when I'm reading other things and people telling me what I should conclude. I like to have a respect for people to come to their own conclusion and let them kind of get the same feeling I got as I research as you make these discoveries as you go along. If it's told right, the reader can make their own discoveries and respect their brains to come to their own conclusions.
You've been listening to an interview with Carrie Beecham, whose book is Joseph P. Kennedy Presents His Hollywood Years. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.